Jim Keyes, welcome to the Field Swell podcast.
Great to be with you.
We're so honored to have you here today with us at Field Swell. You have been the CEO of two iconic Fortune 500 companies, 7-Eleven and Blockbuster.
I have.
Pretty impressive.
I don't know about impressive. You know, I peddled Slurpees and some DVDs, but.
Okay. What do they say? Under promise, over deliver.
There you go. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No. They were two iconic brands that have served me well because today, anywhere in the world that I travel, people know 7-Eleven. They know Blockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
I have people all the time come up to me with their Blockbuster card.
Wow.
Proudly. It's like, look what I have.
They still have it.
Yeah. I'm like, dude, you have that in your wallet?
Yeah.
So, why?
Right. Time to clean out the wallet, maybe. Yeah. But it's like, or like frame it, you know?
Yeah, I know. One guy actually said, you never know.
Could come back. Mm-hmm. I know from your story that this wasn't all just handed to you and that you worked very hard to make it to the pinnacle of success and to run these mega businesses.
Yeah.
Talk to us about your beginning.
Well, a lot of people assume that someone in a leadership role, a CEO role, kind of had things pretty easy along the way. They went to the best schools. They had everything sort of paved for them. I was quite the opposite, but I think there's a strong message in that because what I've discovered is that the adversity that I faced as a kid, and it wasn't just growing up poor. A lot of people grow up poor, but I had all kinds of catastrophic things, you know, happen, death of parents and, you know, divorce and people killing themselves and blah, blah, blah. Which a lot of people do. They have different kinds of adversity. But what I discovered at a very early age is I can't do anything about those things that are out there.
Right.
But I can do everything about how I respond. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, that difference has been really a superpower for me, recognizing, you know, I can only do what I can control.
Yeah.
But from inside, I can control virtually anything.
We have this whole universe inside of ourselves.
We do.
And so often individuals are trying to control everything on the outside that is totally out of their control.
Right.
Instead of focusing on what they can control, which is their response and their action towards their desired future.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you realized that at a young age.
I did. And I don't know how. I think it was a little good fortune. I mean, everything in life is some combination of hard work and a little bit of luck, and I had some good teachers along the way, I think. We all need encouragement.
Yeah.
And I had people around me who would give me that encouragement and let me believe that I could accomplish anything. Humor me, if you will, I guess that's what they would do.
That almost like delusion of like when you're young and you just go for it and people kind of validate your actions, then you just really start believing in yourself.
True. It's true. But you have to quiet the noise, too, because there are so many people. I compare the times we're in now to what many of us went through in the fifth grade. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of mean kids out there.
Yes.
And they don't mean to be mean. They just, their own fear, their own insecurities make them want to keep anyone else from being an outlier, from succeeding. So they will bully, they will harass, they will make fun of, and that's just noise. But some of us let it influence who we are and it establishes our identity.
Oh yeah. This fear of what other people think. And when others are tearing you down, I almost believe it says more about them than it does about you.
Well, it does, exactly. And we, you know, none of us know what they're going through.
Right.
It took many, many years to realize that a lot of these things that I took personally in the past, nothing about me at all.
Right.
It was all about them. You know, what they were going through. They had a worse home life than I did.
Right.
I mean, I maybe had some poverty. I maybe had some issues, but I still had plenty of love and plenty of support. Mm-hmm. Some of these kids could have grown up in a very wealthy family in very opulent surroundings. But had a terrible personal life. And then that's coming out
right
as bullying or meanness.
Yeah.
it's just their way of acting out.
I love that. Don't take anything personally. One of the four agreements.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to live by.
It is very hard, especially as you move up in the ranks of society or in an organization, and you know, and you open up the New York Post and you see your picture in there, half page with a Pinocchio nose.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We're going to get into that.
Yeah.
We're going to get into that. Let's start with, I'm curious, what was your first job and how old were you?
Flipping burgers.
Okay.
Barely 16 years old. I may have fudged my application just a tad.
Wow. And was that McDonald's. Your desire to go and get a job, or your parents said you have to go work?
Oh, no. That was mine. Yeah.
Wow.
I knew. In my situation, there was really no one there to take care of me. I had no safety net. So if I had any chance of going to school, it was, or having a car or doing anything else, I was just going to have to earn it. So as soon as I could get a job, there was a new McDonald's that opened up in not too far from my hometown.
Yeah.
And I applied. Ended up getting a job, and man, I was the best burger flipper out there.
Yes. How you do anything is how you do everything.
Yeah.
And this mindset of let me be the best that I can be at whatever I'm setting my mind towards resonates throughout everything that you've done.
It wasn't that I wanted to be the best as much as it was I needed to be the best. Mm. Where I was coming from, you know, and this is a great lesson that I learned early. Looked around, a lot of people just didn't really want to work because they were there because they had to be. You know, their parents said, go get a job, or they needed a job for one reason or another, but they felt like that job was something that maybe was beneath them or whatever.
Right.
I approached it as, man, I need this job and I'm going to be the best at it that I can be, because I need another job. And if I can get them to say I was a good worker, then that'll be good. So I was out there, you know, being the best burger flipper, the best lot picker upper.
Yes.
You know,
going above and beyond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a pattern that I established. And I'm sure at some point today we can talk some neuroscience, because that's kind of your
We're going to talk about a psychology background. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize it until very recently, as I started to understand more about neuroscience and neuroplasticity, but I was establishing patterns and reprogramming my brain in a way as early as my teens in a very positive fashion to say, I'm going to be a harder worker. I'm going to be a better worker. I'm going to excel.
Yeah.
And those are all things that I successfully did, that I reprogrammed my brain to think that way.
Yes.
I still do it today.
Yes. I like to say, just as you update your iPhone or your laptop, how often are you updating your own programming?
Love that. Yeah. I may borrow that.
Please.
Yeah.
You're welcome to.
Well, and I've been telling young people when I talk to them today, it's like, look, you come out of the box pre-programmed.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
And we are. It's we have 86 billion nodes, and they're firing electronic impulses back and forth. We are a computer.
Yeah.
That computer comes programmed like a Mac right out of the box.
Right.
But if we want to change that programming, we can and we should as we go through life, because what comes out is protective programming.
Yes.
So we're there to have fear so that we don't get hurt, or we don't get, back in the caveman days, eaten by a lion.
Let's bring in the amygdala.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's what it is.
Yes.
And that amygdala is probably the best and the worst thing that could have happened to humanity, because it kept us, when we had natural predators,
us safe in the wild.
Exactly.
But we're no longer in the wild, but we're operating and using these perceived social threats as actual threats,
exactly.
Life or death situations. When they're not, and fear is clouding our eyes from the actual reality we're living in.
Exactly, and it shows up in the craziest places. I've seen it in the boardroom. I've seen people ready to duke it out in the boardroom, and you go, dude, what are you doing? You know, why are you behaving this way? But they can't help it, because their pre-programmed reaction to what they see as a threat is fight or flight.
Yeah.
And the flight
fists
is worse. The flight is even worse. I'd rather see somebody fist up, ready to duke it out, than the passive aggressive behavior.
Right. without saying a word, but like being, yeah.
We used, at 7-Eleven, we used to affectionately call it the grim fuck. I hope I can say this to your audience. But it was like, yes, boss. Yes, of course.
Right.
That's the best idea I've ever heard. And then they walk out of the boardroom and they go, that's the dumbest thing. I am not going to do that. How do you know?
Yeah.
And it's just deadly in an organization.
Open communication.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So young age, flipping burgers at McDonald's.
Yeah.
And you worked your way up from there.
I did. Well, I was a shift manager. They made me a shift manager. Hard to even imagine, but no one wanted to work the night shift. So I was stupid enough to say, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And they made me a shift manager at like 16 and a half years old. Mm-hmm. So I was able to have responsibility for the first time ever. Mm-hmm. And people tend to dismiss these jobs, you know, as, you know, I was still an hourly worker. I was making a buck and a half an hour, maybe.
Wow.
And people dismiss them as kind of meaningless jobs. But if you step back from it, that job prepared me very well for the corporate world.
Oh, yeah.
It's a matter of decimal points.
Right.
I had inventory, labor, customer issues, quality issues. I had everything in one little bite-sized package in one McDonald's store that 7-Eleven had as a global corporation.
Right. It's all stepping stones. Like, how is what I'm going through now helping prepare me for what's next?
Exactly.
Were you driving to work at McDonald's being like, I can't wait to go to work today. I'm so grateful that I have this job. Like, were these sort of mindset principles and practices becoming instilled in you at that young age, or did you develop them over time?
A little of it. I never hated the idea of going to work. And so I had a little, I wouldn't say at McDonald's, I couldn't wait to get there, you know? The environment was a little rough. I still remember today. I don't know if you've ever worked at McDonald's. You come home, you smell like a hamburger.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I enjoyed the challenge of being at McDonald's. And especially as a shift manager, I had responsibility. So that part I did enjoy.
It all started at McDonald's.
It did.
Your career.
It did.
So from there, talk us through kind of that, from being at McDonald's to starting at 7-Eleven.
Well, it was an interesting journey. I had intended originally to be a lawyer because when you grow up the way I grew up, I had no frame of reference. The business was the factory my dad worked at or nothing that I seemed to be interested in.
Yeah.
McDonald's, maybe they offered me a job at offered to send me to Hamburger U.
Hamburger U.
They did. I know there's a thing called Hamburger U, yeah. But I'd probably still be in the McDonald's network today if I had done that. Maybe I would have been CEO.
Exactly. That was my thought.
Yeah. You never know.
Right.
You never know. I think the chances might have been a little slim. So my career of choice was, I thought I'd be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I studied political science. And then I had a professor intercept me at some point when I was graduating college. Mm-hmm. And he said, Jim, you're going to be a terrible lawyer.
Wow.
Please at least go get an internship in a law firm. Find out what the work is like.
Right.
And he was right. I'm probably a little ADHD.
Okay.
I like being out there.
I like
a lot of variety and things I'm working on.
Right.
So he talked me into applying to Columbia University because they had just started this thing called the JD MBA, where I could get a combined degree in 4 years. He knew money was an issue. Mm-hmm. I didn't think there's a prayer I could get into Columbia or afford it. So I applied just to kind of make him happy. And sure enough, the business school let me in and the law school waitlisted me. So I started backwards at the business school.
Okay.
Ended up with an internship for the summer at a major oil company, Gulf Oil.
Yeah.
They hired me, sent me to Houston. I said, they said, finish the MBA and forget about the law degree, which I did. But I always thought I'd go back to law school.
Okay.
And in a way, having that safety net made me fearless in the corporate environment because
you had
I had
a
nothing
backup.
To lose.
Yeah.
I had a backup plan.
Yeah.
7-Eleven.
So
I got to 7-Eleven via Gulf merged with Chevron.
Okay.
We're going to talk a lot about change because change has sort of been in my DNA from the time I was born and being able to deal with it.
It's the only constant
in
our lives.
It is. Exactly.
But a lot of people don't deal with it well.
Most people don't deal with it well. Yeah, they say they do. Oh, I love change. Yeah. I love them to change, not me.
Right.
I want to change. Yeah, so shortly after joining Gulf, we merged with Chevron. Ironically, spent some time in Dallas. Boone Pickens was bigger than life in Dallas, Texas. He made a run on Gulf Oil. Gulf was weakened. They merged with Chevron. Big Oil, you know, I was a kid. They said, kid, you know, you're going to have to pay your dues here. I thought, oh boy. So a gentleman I was working for ended up at 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven had just acquired the downstream of City Service Corporation called Citgo.
Okay.
So now this this major worldwide convenience retailer now buys an oil company. I knew nothing about the oil business. So they hired some people from the industry to help them run it.
Yeah.
One of which was me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how I got to 7-Eleven, be in the gasoline business.
Incredible. Crazy enough. Yeah. And we know you didn't start there as CEO.
No.
How long were you with 7-Eleven?
I was with them for 20 years, 21 years. And I guess it was probably 12 years between joining the company and being named CEO. Wow.
And in those 12 years, you had various different positions.
I had some challenges. And, you know, the corporate world, I see myself as an entrepreneur.
Yes.
I call myself a corporate entrepreneur. Corporations and entrepreneurs, very different. Beast. Corporation by design is corporate as one, right? Entrepreneur is one being out there being, you know, edgy, taking risks.
Yeah.
So corporations tend to beat the entrepreneur out of it. Maybe I had, because I had a safety net, maybe I had this attitude that it's not personal. Maybe it was the way I could embrace change.
Yeah.
I just said, I'm going to go for it.
Yeah. I love that.
Blocked out the noise.
Yeah.
And it worked.
We have this word we use here, send it.
Yeah.
Put yourself out there. Go for it. Take the risk. You don't know what's on the other side of that.
Right.
And I really believe the magic is venturing into the unknown, which so many are scared to do.
Exactly. But ironically, that's the learning zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many examples. You go to the gym. If you're just sitting there like, if it doesn't hurt, you're not growing muscle, right?
Right, yeah.
You're not gaining.
Right.
And where you really make progress is when it's really painful, really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Life is the same way.
Right. So since you learned, you know, you're big on education and educating yourself and why we do have fear and how fear keeps us stuck.
Yeah.
Were there moments running 7-Eleven that you experienced fear as the CEO, or did you have a way to kind of instead just focus on your desired solution and use knowledge to help guide you?
Never. I'm completely fearless all the time,
24/7. This guy, fearless, a fearless leader.
I wish. No, I am also human.
Yes.
I have an amygdala. Right. They didn't remove it. I wish you could have amygdala removal
surgery. But then it'd be totally reckless.
Yeah, it would be, because then I'd probably, you know, burn myself on a flame.
Right.
No, I had moments of fear, moments of self-protection, if you will. But I think maybe the difference is I would also recognize those and kind of try to redirect myself to say, look, what are you afraid of?
Get out of your own way.
Get out of your own way. Yeah. Let them fire you. In fact,
right.
One of my favorite stories is I got fired once at 7-Eleven. I was like, because I was working on some stuff. And my boss didn't know what it was. It was secret shit I was doing for the CFO.
Yeah.
He got his nose all out of joint and took away my title, took away my admin, basically wanted me to quit.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I'm doing the right thing.
Right.
And I know I'm doing it based on data and based on what's right for the company. If this company fires me for this, this is not the right company.
This isn't where I want to be anyway.
Yeah. I persisted. I kept coming back to work.
Good for you.
And it paid off. That was thank God I did, because I would have perhaps, if fear crept in, if I let that demoralize me and say, you know, maybe I'm not.
Or if you got defensive about it, but you just kept showing up. Bill Walsh, who introduced us.
Yeah.
One of the formulas that he has is persistence plus failure equals success.
Yeah, I like it. It's true.
The persistence. You kept showing up.
Yeah, yeah. Since you mentioned persistence, one of my favorite quotes is from Calvin Coolidge.
Okay.
And it's called Press On. And it talks about, you know, genius will not make you successful. Unsuccessful people with genius is, you know, legendary, and educational loan will not, and all this stuff. And it comes down to persistence and determination, he says, are omnipotent.
Yeah.
And that quote I saw at McDonald's for the first time.
Wow.
It was on the wall.
Yeah.
Took it off the wall.
Yeah.
Burned the edges, took it to shop class in high school, and made a plaque. And that plaque is on my desk today.
Wow.
All through high school, all through college, all through graduate school, every job I've ever had. It just reminds me. It's a constant reminder.
Yeah.
Press on.
So I'm a big visionary. I believe in, like, when I want something, I'm repeating it, I'm writing it down, I'm envisioning it in my mind. How soon into being at 7-Eleven were you like, I'll be the CEO?
Never.
Never.
No. Here's the irony. I know a lot of people think you have to have this plan and you need to, you know, imagine yourself in that role. Mm-hmm. I didn't really see myself being CEO of the company. I was pretty young, too.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit outside of what I thought was even practically achievable. Now, what I did do is say, maybe someday I should be CEO, if not here, somewhere else. Uh-huh. So I'm going to get as much experience as I can and as much stuff. See, what happens, so many of us listen to the outside. You're a financial person. Therefore, your entire career is going to be in the finance vertical. You might move from accounting to finance to treasury, but you're going to stay because that's what you are.
Right.
Right? Or you're an operating person.
As if your identity is fixed.
Yeah. Oh, no, because other people constantly try to establish your identity. They want to put you in a box.
Box.
There's no box.
Right.
Box is in your head or their head. Get out of the box, literally. There is no box. So I said, well, if I want to be the best contributor to this company, I need to know as much about as many roles as possible. So when I'd get stuck, like that guy I was working for in an operating role, kind of stuck. You know what? I can do finance. Why don't you move me, put me in another department so I can learn something different?
Wow.
Now, I was way out of my league in finance.
Right.
Because I did not have a good financial background other than graduate school. But I learned a ton.
Yeah.
And then finally, when it came time to pick a CEO, it was like, well, we can go to the outside or we got this guy, Keyes. He's been CFO, chief operating officer, ran marketing, ran gasoline operations, ran store operations.
Yeah. There's no one who knows more about how everything works than you.
Well, that's ultimately was my point of differentiation, right? And it's such an important lesson here today, especially in a world of technology and AI. We're still vulnerable to everybody wants us to specialize, right?
They do.
Yeah, but it's my breadth of knowledge that was my point of differentiation that made me more valuable than anybody else because everybody else was specialized.
Right, you weren't just good at one thing, you were good at various things.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that is, I think, even more true in this day and age.
Yes, we were hearing so much brand yourself as one thing, become the expert in one thing, but now it's like, how relatable is that? There's only one side of you, you're just good at finance, what else?
I know,
what else do you bring to the table?
It's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a very mature, call him an old guy, but also I'll call him very mature gentleman in Dubai, sat down with me and one day he said, you know, kid, that's how old he was, still called me kid.
Yeah.
But, you know, kid, you know what you got? I was like, what's that? He goes, I don't know if you know this, but you're a really interesting guy. And I was like, oh, thanks. And he said, no. He said, most people don't realize success comes to those who have the most to offer the most people.
Mm.
Breadth of interest. He said, who wants to do business with somebody who's one dimensional?
Right.
But you,
an
artist, you're a pilot, you do this, you do that. You can talk to anyone. Yeah. You can be at a table.
Yeah. You're multifaceted.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm probably an extreme just because I'm very curious and I love to learn about different things and I'd love to do. I'm still trying to find something I'm good at. But there's a really important lesson here because it's true. The more interesting you can be, mm-hmm. and the more you know about, the more things, yes. the more people you can interact yes. with, and I think the better chance of success.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Because then whoever you meet, you have some, there's going to be some overlap to yeah. talk about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Lived in different places, you fly planes, you do different sports,
yeah.
you like different foods, you've had different roles. The more you can diversify yourself.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And there's another really important element a lot of people forget today, because we're in this climate of pulling back, becoming nationalistic, and you know, we don't need the rest of the world. Let's just bring everything back into the United States, et cetera, et cetera. I think that is very short term, because what has made this world so multinational is technology. You know, when I started doing business with 7-Eleven in Japan, we were doing telexes back. We didn't even have fax machines.
Crazy. Wow.
Yeah. And today I can Zoom a buddy in Japan and do a business deal, you know. All I have to worry about is the difference in time zones.
Right, right.
But otherwise, it's yeah. almost simultaneous. And I can even do a Google Translate. And in fact, I just did. I've got a Chinese company I'm working with.
Yeah.
And we've been using an interpreter, because my partner in China, in Beijing, doesn't speak English. So yeah. we're using an interpreter. I sent him a note. Mm-hmm. We changed the time of the meeting. And he responded back in Chinese. No problem. Google Translate.
Yeah.
I responded to the new time in Chinese.
Wow.
The interpreter finally picks it up and goes, you guys, why do you need me?
Right. Wow. But it is true. Technology has made us like there are no borders.
There are no borders. Yeah. yeah. So in here, I've got a chapter I called Cultural Literacy. And it's actually pretty comical, because it's all this, you know, mm-hmm. and fear driven
right.
about DEI and diversity. And diversity has somehow become a bad word. Which it's laughable in a way, because yeah. this is a shrinking world. And forget about those words, because words cause reactions in people,
yeah.
right? So I've recoined it, and I've called it cultural literacy. So it's not about the diversity, if you will. It's about the advantage, your point of differentiation. Mm-hmm. The more cultures you know and understand, mm-hmm. then the more capable you'll be yeah. of taking advantage of this shrinking world and doing business on a global basis. Why wouldn't everyone want to do that?
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah.
It's so true.
And the irony, you don't have to travel to another country. We have so many different cultures here yeah. in the United States.
We do. It's
embrace a cultural melting pot. Embrace your Indian friends.
Yeah.
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 Embrace those people from right. different cultures so they
learn.
Learn.
Yeah.
yeah. Go to their weddings.
Yeah.
Go to the 4-day Indian weddings.
Try their food. Go to their weddings.
Exactly.
Ask them questions you're curious about. Learn about their culture and their way of living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a point of differentiation for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, 20 years from now, when all of those people that said, I don't want to learn about, you know, I don't like this whole blah, 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 mm-hmm. they're going to be on the sidelines, while those who embrace it are going to be the ones
yeah.
successfully doing business.
It's so true. Okay. I want to hear more about your leadership style. CEO of 7-Eleven, yeah. how many employees at like the most you're managing at one point in time?
I jokingly say I've had as many as 1 million employees directly or indirectly. 7-Eleven had
yeah.
like 400,000 direct employees, but then we had international licensees all over the place.
Yeah.
Blockbuster, same thing.
Did you ever feel overwhelmed? Like, how did you ensure everyone was on track with the mission and knew what your vision was for where we were going?
Yeah, you never know. Now, you hit on a really important point, because one of the things I emphasize about leadership is embracing change, having confidence, but clarity is critically important. You can have the best plan in the world, if you can't explain it, articulate it, so that if you're in a multinational company, hundreds of thousands of employees might be able to understand it.
Right.
You can't execute it.
Yeah.
So I worked really, really hard at both communications and clarity. So one of the things I did at 7-Eleven, I copied Sam Walton. And I didn't copy him literally, but Sam Walton believed, when he started Walmart, I can't risk having my vision for this company interpreted 7 or 8 different times as layers of management would take my message and then re-translate
Explain it in their own words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. And that's true.
Yeah.
Because in a company that's as big as Walmart, 7-Eleven, for example, had 12 layers of management between me and the store manager.
Wow.
That's 12 chances. I compare it to the old game of telephone when you were kids and sitting around and whisper something in
right.
Oh
yeah,
ear.
Each person. And they're not asking, like, repeat to me what I just said
yeah,
to you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's management.
Right.
The reality is that's management. And by the time it comes back,
yeah,
it's like bears no resemblance to what you intended.
Right.
So what I did to try to overcome that is I was established at one point, 7-Eleven was the largest user of AT&T telecom services because we would have a weekly teleconference.
Wow.
With those old, remember those old things you'd stick in the middle of the conference table? So we had everybody in the country, just the United States at least. Uh-huh. I didn't attempt it worldwide just yet. We did eventually go there. Uh-huh. But for the United States, we started, let's just get everybody plugged in every Tuesday morning for 1 hour.
Which now would be like a Zoom meeting.
It has evolved now into, like a Zoom meeting.
Brilliant.
We were way ahead of our time. Mm-hmm. But that critical communication to cut through the layers is so important.
Yes. And that's one 30-minute, 1 hour meeting that completely changes everything within the industry when they can hear from you showing up being like, hey.
Exactly. People hear right from your, and then the side benefit is it let people feel so much more connected because people down there at point of sale feel sometimes so far removed from headquarters.
Right.
And that creates natural tension.
That connection by showing up.
Yeah.
So you were at 7-Eleven and it got acquired or sold while you were CEO.
Yes. We sold the company to our largest licensee, 7-Eleven Japan. Really, they're cutting through all of the, why in the world did they buy the company? They were already a licensee of the company. They wanted China. They were very successful in Japan, but they already had huge market share and a huge concentration of stores in Japan. Mm-hmm. And they wanted China. Well, I'm sitting here running a U.S. public company, New York Stock Exchange company. We had excellent licensees in Taiwan, Thailand, Hong Kong, Korea. I couldn't just give them preference.
Right.
So I was creating more or less an auction, if you will, among the various licensees to see who would be the best candidate to license the brand in China. And Japan finally just said, no, we don't want to play that game. We'll buy the company. And they stepped up.
Did you stay on as CEO?
I didn't, no. Okay. That was, after 21 years,
I was ready.
I wanted to try something new. Yeah. Yeah.
And was it straight on to Blockbuster?
No, I took a year. I looked at various options. And ironically, the way I got to Blockbuster was through an effort to take it private because I was, after a very good run at 7-Eleven, I had a lot of private equity interest in helping me buy something. So I was looking at, ironically, Radio Shack and Blockbuster.
Okay.
Give me something broken, tired.
Let me fix it.
Yeah. Let me get in and bring technology.
Yeah.
That was the plan. I got talked into joining as a public company.
Right.
Carl Icahn said famously, Keys, I'm the finance guy. You're the operator. Public, private doesn't make any difference.
Wow.
Yeah, it does make a lot of difference.
And then talk to us about what happened while you were at Blockbuster. We're talking about the news article that you'd mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Well, I joined the company, and the week I joined, they had already violated a bank covenant. So they're in trouble already. Mm-hmm. The banks are ready to shut them down. I was new blood. I had a new plan. Mm-hmm. So the banks basically gave me forgiveness. They said, okay, we'll kick the can down the road. We'll push our forgiveness out at least a year and let you repay this debt in 2009. In hindsight, I shouldn't have done that. If I had a crystal ball, I would have seen, oh my gosh, the world's going to collapse. The financial crisis came.
Yeah,
at the end of 2008. Mm-hmm. So by the end of 2008, we had doubled the earnings of the company. We had bought a streaming video company from the major studios, had a huge competitive advantage versus Netflix, but we also had $1 billion of debt that would have been refinanced if we took it private, could have been refinanced if I didn't negotiate with the banks. Mm-hmm. If I had that to do over, Again,
if you had a magic wand and kind of predicted the future.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. A magic mirror would have been great, or the crystal ball. So when the banks collapsed, we were still okay, but we were really stretched for cash. And the crushing blow actually came when the studios became nervous that we might file for bankruptcy. I'm out there saying we're not going to file. We have no reason to file. Yeah, yeah. The debt refinance was a pain, but we could have eked our way through. Yeah. But at some point, I had some very hostile debt holders that were wanting to push the company into bankruptcy. And they were spreading the rumor that we're going to file. And one of the studios got cold feet and said, we're going to take their terms from 90 days to cash. And then the others followed like dominoes that sucked about $300 million in cash flow out of the company in a matter of weeks. So it forced our hand.
Was this a really stressful time for you?
Yeah, it was very stressful. Now, I still had options. I had strategic options because we knew that we weren't going to be able to dominate the streaming business by ourselves. We didn't have enough of a balance sheet. Just like Netflix is strong, but they're not the only out there. And we were trying to be the aggregation so that we'd be the primary go-to place for streaming. And so I knew I needed a strategic partner. I had very active discussions with AT&T, with Dish Networks, because they had distribution. Korea Telecom randomly was one that was very interested in partnering. The best and the most interesting was Google, who saw the opportunity to have YouTube, something that they had just acquired, YouTube, in about 2008. They thought, we'll take YouTube and everything free goes on YouTube, everything paid goes on Blockbuster, and we'll be your distribution partner.
Yeah.
In a joint venture kind of arrangement. That would have been a huge game changer.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the rumor in the picture that I joked about.
Talk to us about the article.
I mean, it's just one of those things. I'm out there saying we're not going to file. The rumor comes out that we are. Yeah. The New York Post called me on it and said, oh, liar, liar, pants on fire kind of thing. Put a picture of me with a Pinocchio nose. But again, it's not personal.
Right.
You know, frustrating.
Yeah.
Maybe angering.
Yeah.
But not personal. So I stayed the course. I could quit, bailed out. Yeah. I didn't start the mess.
Yeah.
But I stayed the course. And Google, unfortunately, based on that rumor, pulled their deal. So the next best option was Dish Network. And we successfully restructured the company with Dish. They then bought it. They ran it for two or 3 years. Dish ultimately were the ones that shut the stores down and decided not to pursue the streaming option. And the reason is they were and are obsessed with quality. They didn't like the status of the streaming viability at the time because we still had buffering as late as 2012. Yeah. And not the greatest service. So their vision was to use their bandwidth, which they had acquired a lot of spectrum. They wanted to go directly to mobility. And when they saw that that wasn't happening with the administration at that point, they decided to pull the brand and put Blockbuster on the shelf where it sits today.
Wow.
Yeah. Never know. They could bring it back though.
Yeah. What was your biggest learning from that piece of your life?
Yeah, biggest learning, the hard learning is, the realization that even though you know it's not personal, people personalize it. Mm-hmm. So even today, when I post something about Blockbuster, I'll see at least 30% of the comments are, oh yeah, this is the idiot that didn't buy Netflix.
The haters going to come out.
Oh yeah. I got a 15-year-old kid who'd never been in a Blockbuster store.
He wasn't even alive when Blockbuster existed.
Right. But he's a genius who says, oh, this guy.
The expert.
Yeah.
Because there were rumors that what Netflix wanted to buy
Which was true. It actually happened in the year 2000.
Okay.
But it was the year 2000 when Netflix stock was struggling. They were 79 cents a share.
Right.
So if that 15-year-old kid was born,
I would have told him
you should have bought the stock for 79 cents.
So
you're such a genius.
Exactly. Many individuals wouldn't know how to continue or handle a challenge like that. Mm. You stayed the course.
Yeah, that's the advantage that I think I had. I call it my gift. You know, now that I'm a social media guy, which is really kind of hard for me to even say.
Right.
This is a whole brave new world.
He's a great follow, you guys. You're traveling around. You're flying yourself to speak at different events. You're podcasting. You're talking about your book.
I'm having fun with it. I've discovered it's a new medium.
Yeah.
And for all of the grief it gets with people thinking that it's doom scrolling and it's, you know, kids rotting their brains, I've got a video with this gift that I talk about that has over 50 million views.
Incredible.
Yeah. And it's young people that, of course, they've heard of the Blockbuster brand. They know 7-Eleven, and they're wanting to learn.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why are they watching me, talking head, talk about my gift? Mm-hmm. They're learning from it.
How you would describe your gift.
Okay. It's really simple. It's three things. It is, you've got to be able to embrace change. We talked about that. Mm-hmm. And recognize that the things that happen in the macro universe are inevitable. You can't control them, but you can control your response. That's the magic recognition, and that change equals opportunity if you can do that. The acronym CEO, right?
CEO, change equals opportunity.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's so true, and that's the role of the CEO.
Yeah.
But so why is that so hard? You might think, okay, that should be alone. That's all we need to say. No, because most of us, even me, have problems with the confidence piece, because you can't embrace change. You can't manage your own reaction to change unless you have confidence. And confidence is something that can be learned. We can talk about that more.
Yeah.
But you can learn. Some people think, oh, you got to be born confident. Old Bill, he's confident. You know, Sally, not so much. No, that's not true. Bill learned confidence.
Yeah.
So that's the second. And then the third is this idea. Now you've been able to embrace change. You're confident enough to do something about it. You don't have clarity, inbound clarity, listening properly, understanding, critical thinking, outbound clarity, effective communications, you're still not going to be able to execute on that change. So those three things, change, confidence, clarity, I think are what helped to propel my career. But it's not just career. Your personal life, your interaction with others.
Yeah. And this brings us to your book.
Yeah.
Because education is freedom. The more I learn, the more clarity I have, the more confidence I have, the better I'm able to navigate change.
Yeah.
So instead of sitting in fear, instead of sitting in low confidence, instead of sitting in confusion, pick up a book, listen to a podcast,
absolutely,
watch a YouTube video, become an expert, become the expert of your life.
Absolutely. It's agency. It's like, I've got control of my life. If I can channel, especially this confidence thing, if I can realize that I have nothing to fear, because here's my analogy, ridiculously simple, but when you're a little kid and you're scared of the dark, you turn on the light. Mm. Ah.
Yes.
Now I look around.
Right.
Now I have knowledge. I don't have anything to fear. Good. I can go back to sleep. And that's what knowledge is.
Yeah.
It's just turning on the light. It's like taking away the mystery.
Yeah.
But then there's another piece of the puzzle. This is where people get tripped up sometimes. Okay, well, I can learn all about things I know. What about things I don't know? What about things nobody knows? But there's an answer for that too, because I can, now I've been all over the world talking about this balance between knowledge and what I call faith. And I have to be really careful, because I'm sitting in Kuwait talking about faith,
right?
I'm the only Christian in the room, in a room full of Muslim gentlemen.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, so here's what I mean. And I use Paulo Coelho, the alchemist.
Yes.
You want something bad enough, the universe will conspire to make it happen.
Yes.
I use George Lucas, Star Wars. Because when he had Yoda teaching Luke, it's exactly what he was teaching him, the balance between knowledge and the Force.
The Force
be with you.
You can't deny it.
The Force is, I didn't know this until I actually then looked it up. I was like, did he mean that as a metaphor for faith? And apparently he did, because it would be universal.
I think faith is quiet confidence.
Faith is
trusting that if you do pursue your highest and best vision and you walk toward it, miracles will happen all around you.
Exactly.
Energy, God, source, higher spirit, whatever you believe in.
Exactly. It can be prayer. Yeah. It can be meditation. Yeah. It can just be sitting quietly, being present, mm-hmm. right?
Was faith always a part of your journey?
Yeah, fortunately it was. And it's kind of been a mixed bag because my dad was Baptist. My mom was Catholic. You know, back in the day, the Catholics didn't like the Baptists. Yeah. And everybody like pointing fingers. So probably the single biggest learning that I took away from all of that confusion about faith growing up is that what's more important is that faith's inside of you. It's from within.
Oh, yeah.
And if you can channel that, that belief, at least in yourself, and that there's a greater force in the universe.
You can believe in something or you can believe in nothing, and that's up to you. I'm going to believe in something more.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's easy to judge other people and say, oh, no, mine's right, yours is wrong. If it's inside of you, then it's right.
Yeah.
But that's a really powerful balance that I never thought I'd be out talking about faith because I'm a classic CEO.
Right.
You know, I don't talk about politics. I don't talk about religion. But I found I can pull this off because it's an important piece of the puzzle.
A huge piece of the puzzle.
It really is.
And it
truly can be non-denominational if positioned correctly that, you know, this is about you having agency in yourself. Mm-hmm. And what can I do?
Yeah.
Not let the world dictate who I am. I can do it by learning. And I can do it by believing, right? Those two things. Now, what do I have to fear?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, it's so true.
Right?
I love it. No, the faith piece is huge. And I think at any moment that we can have faith, we realize we're co-creating and we're not alone.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The self-belief. So if we were to say the biggest thing that you think differentiates those who really make it in business and in life compared to those who don't, what would that be?
I think it is being this idea of being fearless, but I've got to take it to another direction because there's short-term success that you can have, even if you're fearless, at the expense of others. You know, we see it out there. Yeah. It's, as a leader, it's really easy to leverage other people's fear. I can tap right into your amygdala and I know how. Right?
Yeah.
And people do it and they create that reaction and they get loyalty. I'm the only one that can fix this. Mm. They're going to hurt you. I can help you.
Yeah.
And I'm the only one. And that, you know, sadly that works because we're humans and we tend to be tribal. Mm-hmm. And we tend to revert back to that caveman brain and put our values aside and follow that lead. Mm-hmm. And that works. And you see it in business. You see the bad bosses that, you know, bully.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they can create value for a while. The question is it sustainable? And so my preference when it comes to, you know, you said, what do you tell people? Yes, be fearless, but be fearless in a sustainable way. Mm-hmm. Which means channeling that thing that I call brand, because each of us has a brand.
Yeah.
And when I'm talking to young people, especially, I love to have them tell me what their favorite product is, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Coke or Pepsi, why? And they talk about the packaging and I explain, well, your packaging, it matters.
Yes.
But what's more important than the packaging? Because Coke may be your favorite brand, but it comes up with a package design that you go, eh, I don't like
it. Right.
It's what's inside. Right?
Yeah.
And what's inside of us, people forget how important integrity, humility, gratitude, passion. Who wants to do business with a jerk?
So true. Yeah.
Who wants to follow a jerk? Well, we will short term if they trigger our fear.
Yeah.
That's why it's important for us to have agency and say, no.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be tribal. Yeah.
Longevity.
Yeah.
Sustainability. Yeah.
Sustainable competitive advantage. Sustainable leadership.
So takeaway for our listeners.
Yeah.
After all the amazing points we've hit on your story and how to handle change and how fear triggers the amygdala, where can they start today?
They can start. And I would suggest, first of all, they start with the self-awareness, the recognition that they can do something about this. No one's dictating their success, their failure, their future. They are in control of their own destiny. So the question is, how do they do it? And my suggestion is, take on at least those three things: change, confidence, and clarity, and practice on the confidence side. Because, you know, you're right, we talked about a lot of things, but probably the most important thing we talked about all day is the idea that our brain is a computer. It is reprogrammable.
Yeah, it's plastic, quite literally.
It is.
Yeah.
Neuroplasticity, yeah, is a beautiful thing. And most of us, this is a relatively new science. Most of
it
us
is.
Don't know how,
yeah,
to build confidence. But here's my last example. I'll give you another little story. If you wonder why a pilot is not scared in turbulence, right? Turbulence happens and everybody's in the back going, oh my
freaking
God,
out.
Oh my God,
freaking
we're gonna crash. And the pilot's up there, you know,
right.
And why is that? Why does he not have fear or she not have fear? Uh-huh. Well, because they have reprogrammed their mind through preparation, knowledge. They know what's causing the turbulence. Okay. And they also have a faith in their ability to fly this aircraft. But what a pilot does once a year, and I do this because I also fly.
Yeah.
I get locked in a simulator for 3 days, and I never realized what they were doing. They are managing my neuroplasticity. They're throwing me every bad thing that could happen, forcing me to react to it. And what I'm reacting with is, I know exactly where my emergency procedures checklist is. I pull it out and I step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 through the fixes. What I'm doing is, I'm using knowledge and overriding my amygdala and going straight to my prefrontal cortex to have, yeah, the best possible solution, wow, for that crisis. And during that time, I have no time for fear. There's no fight or flight in the,
yeah,
cockpit.
Yeah.
You can use that same practice in the boardroom, mm-hmm, around your family dinner table, to eliminate conflict,
yeah,
by helping establish new patterns, mm-hmm, starting with yours and then,
yeah,
hopefully your family or your coworkers.
It's like, do the thing that scares you and prepare yourself on how you're going to execute it.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, I quoted him in the book, Harvey McKay. I was asking about this concept of confidence. How do I can't,
yeah,
just tell people be confident. I have to,
right,
tell them,
like, snap your fingers. Yeah.
Yeah. He said, I'll give you my gift, Jim.
Yeah.
He goes, 3 words, prepare to win. And I said, okay, well, what's that mean?
Yeah.
But prepare to win is literally, the more preparation you have, the more chances of,
yeah,
success you'll have and the more confidence you'll have.
Yeah.
Whether it's a test, Tom Brady walking on the football field.
Yeah. And how does someone who is successful, how do they dress? How do they walk? How do they act? Kind of like,
yeah,
start becoming that version of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Focus on your brand. Mm-hmm. Differentiation doesn't just, it's not just product. We're all differentiating every single day. People say today, oh, do I need to go to college?
Yeah.
No. I mean, you learn anything you want to learn on the internet.
So true.
But for at least the next 20 or 30 years, credentials might have an impact. Even if you're an entrepreneur and you're going to borrow money from the bank, the very first thing they're going to say is, where'd you go to school?
Right.
It's all part of your brand.
Anything we didn't cover today
that
you
want to,
we covered a lot, that you want to leave our listeners with. Yeah.
We haven't talked about bunnies or golden retrievers.
I love both. I've had both.
I know. Me, yeah, too. Me too. I have a golden retriever now.
Yeah. Boy or girl?
You, boy, yeah.
What's his name?
Aspen.
Aspen,
yeah.
So cute.
He's my co-pilot.
Light or dark?
He's an English cream golden.
Okay, great.
And he's
so beautiful.
I've had several goldens,
yeah,
during my life. He is the most loving ever. It's just amazing.
They're such kind dogs. I have a Cavalier King Charles.
Oh, yeah, smart.
And they have similar personalities.
Yeah.
Very snuggly, cuddly, warm,
yeah,
friendly. We call him Happy. He's just smiling all the,
oh,
time.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And, yeah,
they look at you.
Oh, like, yeah. And he has these eyebrows that look similar to mine.
That's awesome. I love it.
Jim, you're so wonderful. Anything, sorry, where can the listeners find you?
Oh, yeah, jameswkeys.com, K-E-Y-E-S, is my website.
Okay.
And I'm working, they'll see a thing out there called Meta Skills. I'm I've captured 9 of the meta skills in this book, and I'm trying to expand that to 99,
okay.
which is all of those things that separate humans from machines.
Yeah.
Which is pretty
important.
We need
to learn
AI
that.
World. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to have some fun, I'm out there on social media.
Yeah.
Jay Keys, author.
Amazing.
First initial, last name, author. And I'm out on TikTok and Instagram, and you can see pictures of my dog.
Love. You're a super fun follow. I'll link it all in the show notes. Thank you so much for visiting us today and sharing your story. It's been wonderful to learn more about you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope somebody was able to take away a couple of nuggets.
Oh, yeah. Major nuggets.